Welcome back or welcome to the Single Track Podcast. I'm your host, Finn Melanson, and in this episode, I'm talking with Jared Campbell, who probably needs no introduction, but just in case, he's a four-time finisher of the Barkley Marathons, a past winner of the Hard Rock 100, the creator of the Running Up for Air series, the genius behind classic FKT routes like the Wasatch Ultimate Ridge Linkup. He's also a dedicated environmentalist and top-notch engineer. He's certainly someone to admire, and I think you'll really enjoy this conversation, though. Before we get started, I'd like to give thanks to Knack for supporting this episode. Knack is the official nutrition partner of Singletrack, and one thing I have not acknowledged enough about them is their commitment to making the most sustainable sports nutrition products on the market. They are a certified B Corp, which means they meet the highest standards of social and environmental accountability. They rely on plant and cricket-based proteins to reduce pollution and use fewer resources. They use upcycled ingredients to reduce the need for new raw material. And by 2025, 100% of their packaging will be reusable, recyclable, or compostable. Pretty cool leadership on the environmental front. If you're curious to try their products, feel free to use code SINGLETRACK15 at checkout for 15% off your next order there. And with that, let's get to the conversation with Jared Campbell. Jared Campbell, it is great to have you on the Single Track Podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Finn. Thanks. Happy to be here with you today.
Great to have you here. And starting with Barkley, I am curious about what brought you back this year. So yeah, talk about your why to come back for more at this race.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think something this magnitude, you have to have a pretty strong why. Otherwise, you're not going to finish. My why over my many years now at Barkley has changed quite a bit. From the very first one of just, you know, really wanting to see if you could do it, to my next reason to try to do it was to do it on my own and not have to be dependent on someone to kind of guide me around the course. I wanted to play, I would define that maybe as the second finish that I had. After that, there was part of me that really had the desire to help somebody else do that. And I've returned in multiple different years with different friends and stuff to help try to have somebody else be successful. I gave it a breather for a little bit after that, and my heart was still drawn to Frozen Head. There's something just really unique about the experience and the park and the community. So I gave it another try after that. I had a few where I didn't finish. And so I would say the thing that, at least on the surface, has drawn me back there has been to really try to close it out on a good note. I didn't want the end of my chapter out there to be one of, you know, failure out there. So to the extent you can try to control that, that's the thing that really brought me back this year, was to really do all that I could to try to finish on a high note out there with a finish. So
a lot to unpack there. I mean, the first thing, it sounded like there was a bit of finality there in your answer. Is Barkley still going to be a beacon for you in some way, shape, or form? Or are you done at this event in terms of racing?
Yeah, I mean, you picked up on something that really is present for sure, which is I do have the intent of it being, you know, kind of a closing of a chapter there. It's been such an incredible activity event for my life in so many ways. And over the years, you know, it really has taught me a lot of things in different ways. But at this stage, I really went into it with the mindset of do all that I could to finish, but close the chapter. I've done that before on other important races. I did that with Hard Rock years ago. That was a huge defining race for more than a decade of my life. And people didn't believe I was going to close the chapter on that. I did 10 there, and I did close the chapter, walked away, and the subsequent years helped out, volunteered, et cetera, loved it. And it feels really good to try to have some, you know, real important, meaningful chunk of your life invested in something like that, but then also closing the door at some point. And that was my intent, has been and is still my intent with Barkley for sure. Some of that too is just a byproduct of the point in my life with everything else going on professionally and family wise. That's the intent, is to really, tie it up. I mean, I'll always be so connected to the community and the race, and I hope to stay involved, to some extent, in the wherever the race goes from a planning standpoint and things of that nature. But in terms of my personal participation, I feel very honored to have gotten so much out of it and been able to participate so many years. And there is some point where you really need to step back and let others have a go at it.
I think it speaks to the uniqueness of Barkley, because you mentioned that in certain years, maybe your purpose there was different than others. And in some of those years, you were going there almost intentionally as a guide. Like, you could sort of be like a shepherd at Barkley, which I think is so fascinating.
Yeah, it's really true. The most unique year for sure is your first year there, your virgin year, because it doesn't matter if you're the best athlete in the world, you're at the mercy of being with someone or some group of people. For sure, you have to. I mean, even if the best in the world, you know, came to the event, your experience is one where you're very dependent on other people. There's no way someone could just launch off on their own and rally through it. And that's cool. I mean, that's an amazing, that first year experience is incredible. You are a student the whole race, or at least the first four laps, and then you get a little chance to walk on your own on lap five. And a lot of people fail on lap five, right, because they haven't learned how to walk. And by that, I mean real navigate through the course and make decisions and whatnot. But that first year is pretty unique. And yeah, every subsequent year for me has been quite different, both my experience in the race, but also the role that I have played relative and with other runners. For sure. I mean, some might not know, but the way the start line is sort of selected, or the entrants are selected, some form of logic involved in that is to make sure it's seated with enough people who know what they're doing and enough, you know, people who don't. If it was all brand new virgin folks there, you'd have a whole bunch of lost people in the woods, you know, for a couple days. And then if you had just all experienced people, no new folks would be in there. So there has to be a good chunk of people, a third, a half, I don't know what Laz shoots for there, of people who do know their way around, because you're kind of a mentor for, you know, the rest of the field.
One of the things that I've always been curious about, especially among the athletes, the veterans that do this event each year, is whether there's a culture of, you know, I know the lay of the land and it's part of my job, in addition to trying to get the five laps, to also help out the people that are new? Or is there more of a mixed interpretation about what it means to be a veteran, and some will go at it solo and they're right for taking that approach as well?
I think it varies. You know, I don't think that like the culture sort of dictates what it means to be a veteran by any means. I think it's changed a little bit over time, but you know, depending on the person, some person might want to use the fact that they know the course to help people. Others might want to use that to benefit themselves, right? I mean, to some extent, it's a test of what do you do with that knowledge and that experience. But I think, you know, it just naturally happens where veterans end up pairing up with new people. I mean, if you're new there, if it's your first year, your number one objective should be to find someone who knows what they're doing, who's preferably your speed or a little bit slower, and then just pair up with them and learn as much as you possibly can. Follow them, but don't just blindly follow. Learn. You know, I, the people I talk to is like, just make sure you absorb everything you possibly can, the way things look, the way things smell. Be looking backwards a lot to learn the course in reverse, because you'll be going that way at some point, you know. That, yeah, you really need to be a student, and you have to pair up with someone who knows what they're doing. Unlike any other race, right? You could go run pretty much any other ultra marathon, follow the markers, and be fine, but not a Barkley.
I am really curious to hear you talk about sort of the attention to the detail that you have to bring to this race, not just on race day, but in the lead up, and how that might differ from other races you've done in the past. And maybe the question I have here is whether you think complete preparation for this event or complete commitment for this race is a non-negotiable, or whether somebody can kind of treat this as like one of the three or four races they have in a calendar year, and you know, lightning can strike and they can sort of get by just based on talent. What do you think there?
Well, I think if you went back in the history books and you read the stories, right, some of the race reports from Barkley finishers and even the non-finishers are awesome. People should go back and read it. I mean, there's definitely a trend of those who do the most research and are the most maybe obsessed, committed, if you want to use that word, are the ones who have the highest probability of success. So for sure, you've got to be pretty focused. I mean, if you were training for Barkley and then, you know, 3 weeks later you had a, you know, road turkey trout or something, chances are you might struggle because it's fairly specialized the way you prepare for it, right? It's a pretty different regimen than any other, you know, 100-mile race. So it's pretty focused. I think you have to be quite focused. I mean, talent gets you a long ways for sure, but being pretty specific about the way you prepare for it physically and mentally is very important, I would argue.
So maybe there's like karma to all the deliberate practice that you put in, and it's pretty rare that someone could just on-site this and lightning would strike.
Yeah, I mean, there haven't been that many first-time finishers. I think there's been a handful. But I would argue that those people didn't finish on the first time just because they were good and got lucky. I mean, they were quite obsessed, and they really were methodical and well had done their research. They had really approached it, controlling every possible variable that they could control. I don't think anyone stepped in just sort of willy-nilly and magically pulled it off. Suppose it might be possible for some people, but at this point, I would say a common thread among finishers has been a lot of obsession and focus on it.
Talk a bit too about the magic of Frozen Head State Park and what inspires you about those mountains in particular, you know, in addition to what makes the event itself so special.
You know, it's interesting. I think people have a distorted view of what the park looks like. In many years, the imagery that comes out of it really comes from two locations. So I think unless you're a participant in it, your view of the park is kind of odd. You have a view of what it looks like in the campground, and that's great. You know, we all love a good campground. You have a view from the fire tower, which is the only other spot really on the whole course that anybody can see it. I mean, you know that. You were up there. If you're there taking pictures or you want to see folks, it's the only place you can go. And that's a neat spot for sure. But in a way, I like that the story isn't told. Like, the story is pretty limited in the way it can be visually told. And what I like about that is it makes it mysterious, and it makes it special for those who are lucky enough to be out there on the course, because the course is incredible. Like, I love the course. And the viewer who's just seeing things posted online, Instagram, you know, X, whatever, sort of sees it in a really, really limited lens in these kind of bleak views, right? Because it's taking place in a time of year before things are blooming and growing. So it's kind of stark and gray. It's always gray. It's almost always raining. It wasn't really this year, but it's almost always dark and gray and, you know, like a Blair Witch Project scene. And that's what the outside world thinks Barkley is. It's just this horrible, miserable thing. But to someone who's been out on the course a lot, man, it's beautiful out there. It's really a spectacular place. The drainages you drop into, there's a lot of water everywhere. Certainly a lot more than I'm used to. We're used to here out in the desert of Utah. So I love that. I love the streams. You know, and you actually don't want it to be starting to bloom yet. If you show up there and like there's an early bloom, that's a bad sign because it means, you know, stuff starting to grow, including like, you know, poison ivy and other things you don't want. So on some level, it's kind of this stark thing, but I have this really beautiful connection with it. Maybe because, you know, in a big 60-hour push, you know, it's you're experiencing that part of really long endurance things, which strips you down and allows you to really sort of have an appreciation for beauty and simplicity. So my perception of the park is I just think it's gorgeous. It's beautiful. And I guess as I close this chapter as a participant in the race, I'm really excited to bring my family back there, bring my kids back, you know, outside of the context of the race, and just go visit the park, go camp in the campground and go hike around. There's tons of beautiful trails, waterfalls everywhere. It's a spectacular place. And I think a lot of folks looking at the race and formulating an opinion based on the pictures they see, they're not seeing the beauty that is Frozen Head State Park. It's an incredible place.
Is the course as hard as advertised?
It's pretty wicked. Yeah. I mean, I don't know, how's it advertised?
Wow, Where Dreams Go to Die, The Race That Eats Its Young. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess if that's the headline, I think it lives up to that. Yeah. I mean, it depends. You know, Laz describes it as well. It has a net elevation gain of 0, so it can't be that bad. You know, it's 100.00 miles despite whatever changes get made. So, you know, net elevation gain of 0 and 100 miles, you know, it's not too bad. No, it's brutal. It's brutal. And again, something you really can't appreciate until you're on it. Even with the metrics of like distance and elevation gain and descent, it doesn't capture the type of terrain. And I think this year, especially with the new section, it was unbelievable. The section that got added, in terms of just how gnarly it was awesome. So yeah, it lives up to the hype.
Well, I remember because I was reading your 2016 trip report. This would have been a couple years ago. And, you know, you were talking about how with this course, it's evolutionary, it's self-correcting to sort of maintain that barely possible objective. And you were saying way back in 2016 that based on sort of the way things were trending, you would fear what this course would look like by the time the 2020s rolled around. So yeah, do you feel like that 2024 version sort of lived up to your fears from 8 years ago? Like, has it truly gotten that much more difficult?
It's a good question. I mean, I do think it's definitely fair to say it's a lot more difficult. A big part of why there were any finishers this year were because the weather was really good. I think if you throw any weather at the current modern course, it's pretty much unfinishable, in my opinion. Whereas my prior years where I did finish, I had horrific weather in many of those years. 2014, I had a lot of rain, tons of rain, tons of snow. That would be really tough to finish the course from this year with the weather we had back then, for sure. So it's quite a bit harder.
One thing I'm curious about is sort of like the nature of the challenge for you this year. Like, obviously it ended up being your fourth finish, quite historic, but I know that in years past it's changed for you. Like in some years it's sort of been you versus yourself. Other years it was you versus the course. Other times you were facilitating someone else's experience. What was it for you this year?
I would say that it was us versus the course this year.
Say more if you don't mind.
Well, we had hands down the strongest starting line in the history of Barkley, for sure. I mean, that's evident by how many people were together in the early laps, lap 1, lap 2, lap 3, how many people started lap 4, how many people finished lap 4, how many people started lap 5. It was definitely an us versus them in a way I've never felt. And it's just a sign of how the caliber of people interested and ultimately in the race has really increased, for sure, in a really cool way. I mean, that group that, you know, that marched out together on the first few laps was remarkable. It was so fun to look around and just like think about some of the, you know, the accomplishments and things folks had done in those starting groups. But we were just this little squadron of, you know, 10, 12, 15 people, maybe more or less together, you know, within a few minutes of each other, in the early first lap. And it was cool. I mean, in past years, 2014 for me was one where I really wanted to do it without needing a guide, right? Brett Mann from the early documentary was really pivotal to me finishing 2012. I really wanted to go back and just see if I could do it on my own, navigating on my own, making decisions on my own, with really, really bad weather. I did that in 2014. That was really cool. And so I had nobody with me in that year. But what was so cool, and I think we really all needed it to tackle the course. So, you know, people are getting better, stronger, faster, but then like the group component of it, the team component was stronger than I've ever seen it. And it kind of needed to be for all of us to get into the course, into the, you know, to do as well as we all did. And then in the end, you know, we still had not a lot of time left over at the end, but I saw like group support and group energy kind of take us way further than it ever had in the past.
That's interesting. So in years past, like what precipitated the change from smaller groups to what we saw this year, like the 15 to 18 person horde? Was there anything said kind of beforehand about who would group up, stuff like that?
No, nothing was really set, at least in conversations I was in. It wasn't like there was any strategizing, you know, the night before or something. Like, hey, let's team up. I just think it happened just naturally. And I think the education is really spreading. Like you have to, you know, they're really, if you really are going into this wanting to finish five laps, and hopefully most people are going in wanting that, desiring that, committed to that, the mindset is you got to stay with the front of the pack or pretty dang close to it, right? And which is to say, if you're not in the front-ish of the group, right at, you know, by the end of lap one, you might have sealed your fate. And so the fact that there were, you know, a dozen plus people all coming in on lap one with a really solid lap one time was a sign to me that the group, like the average commitment in the group, was the highest it's ever been, because everyone's like, I want in. I got to stay with this group, you know, for a whole lap or two laps or three laps. Like everybody just knows they have to do that to set themselves up to have the possibility of succeeding. That's how I read the fact that so many people were so strong on lap one and lap two. I mean, it told me more people are capable and care than ever have in the past.
Fascinating. Okay, so the group dynamics. I also think what you said there about the course being borderline unfinishable, unless there's sort of like a weather assist there, is interesting. Any other key takeaways for you from this year's event, just from observing those around you, experiencing the course, talking with Carl, talking with Laz, anything else interesting about this year's version that came to mind for you?
I mean, I think the diversity of the, you know, competitors, I mean, it's always a really diverse race, but I think in the recent years, maybe the last 5 years or something, it'd be interesting to look at the data. You know, the number of really strong people from all over the world, that's amazing to me. I don't know if it was that different from recent years, but it's really something else to look around and see the best, you know, some of the strongest people from England, from France, from Scotland, from New Zealand, from, you know, I mean, you name it. It was so cool. And, you know, we were all just people doing what we love. And I found that so awesome and inspiring just to be with these like-minded people from, it didn't matter where in the world you were from. We all spoke the same language on the trail, you know, and what we were trying to do. And it was so cool. And it was almost like our different backgrounds brought different strengths to it. But, you know, there weren't that many people from the U.S. I don't know the total number in the end, but certainly in that front group, there were just a couple. And I thought that was so cool. I really loved that. Different languages, you know, different accents, different dialects. I mean, it was interesting as you work together verbally. You know, I'm trying to decipher my Kiwi filter on my brain here. I remember, you know, mixed with a whole lot of French out there, because there's a lot of French speaking folks on the course. I thought I saw that as like a really big strength of the group and a unique thing too, that people brought, you know, wherever their training is. It's like for a while there, the strongest folks came from maybe the same area, but man, here it was super strong people training in the Alps or the Pyrenees or the Wasatch Mountains, you know, and I just thought that was so, I loved that multinational component to it.
I know you said it earlier, but I think it's worth restating here. I find it also fascinating what you said about sort of like there's a reward for collaboration and sort of group contributions in those first four laps, but then it starkly pivots and in that fifth lap, you're totally rewarded or penalized for individual competence. And so that whole concept of like turning on the record button in your eyes and having that ability to multitask and not just, you know, physically survive the brutality of that course, but also really studying and internalizing the topology, the features, where books are, et cetera, that makes this so much more impressive to me. And it's something that having been on the ground for the first time this year was like sort of a visceral appreciation that I took from it.
It's a good point. I mean, I guess to just add my angle on that, maybe, yeah, you've got to get through and survive for 10, 20, 30 hours, you know, physically and mentally, and really never let either crumble. your body's going to break down. Mine certainly does, despite feeling like I handle it pretty well. But then keeping your mind together through it all. However, at the same exact time, while you're executing that over many, many hours, still acknowledging the fact that you've got to be a student, you've got to understand the terrain, you've got to try to make the best navigational decisions, but all of us screw up. And I had my own set of, you know, navigational mistakes for sure. Everybody did, I'm sure. And so you've got to be ready to handle that mess up, you know, and then minimize the impact that it has. And so it becomes like, you've got to still maintain this component of problem solving. Okay, when I went into this drainage and I hit the bottom of it at the wrong spot, how do I, you know, ascertain where I am, what I did wrong, get back on track as quickly as I possibly can. And oh, by the way, I'm like 50 hours in and really sleep deprived. So how do I sort of keep that little ability as my mind and body go? And that's a huge thing, because even some of the best athletes in the world will screw up on lap five, and it can easily be the end of your race, because nobody leaves and starts lap five. Nobody did this year with much buffer at all, right? No one could handle a 1 or 2 or you know, a 2 hour navigational mistake. No one had the time for it.
Quick break to thank Rabbit, the official apparel partner of Singletrack. Rabbit has a few new arrivals on their website worth checking out, including new colorways for their High Country short sleeve t-shirt, their Shredder shorts, and one of my personal favorites, their Deflector sunshirt. Go check it all out at runinrabbit.com and feel free to use code SINGLETRACK20 at checkout for 20% off your next order. I don't know if this has been reported on yet by like I Run Far or Outside, but one of the coolest scenes that I witnessed at Barkley this year, besides the finishes, was seeing your interaction with Jasmine Paris at the lap 4 to 5 transition, where you know, the decision was made that she would go clockwise, you would go counterclockwise. And for listeners and viewers out there that aren't aware of what transpired, talk about that scene and sort of just how you contributed to it and how it ended up making a difference possibly in the outcome of the event.
Yeah. So Jasmine and I had spent a bit of time together on lap 4, and lap 4 is a really, really hard lap. It's probably the crux of the whole thing for sure. In the sense that so much can go wrong, especially when lap 4 is a night lap, which this year it mostly was, if I recall. Certainly there was a big chunk in the night. And she and I were together along with Greg, from Christchurch, New Zealand. So it was the three of us together. I guess I'm leading up into this in camp between 4 and 5, and I think it's kind of important. We were going through the hardest part, the new part of the course, descending it, which was the worst direction because it's just a rat's nest of, you know, super steep, super loose, super sharp Sobriar kind of terrain. Anyway, the point is, we're going down this together. We were throwing time away left and right. I mean, we were slow, we were dumb, we were making mistakes. And you could feel here, there were the three of us who mentally up until that point had nothing but success in our, you know, in our minds. And suddenly we're throwing time away, a lot of time. And eventually we got to the bottom of this, and then we did a big climb and got a little bit turned around and lost on the climb and had this little three-person discussion about how we get back on track. And based on the compass and the gradient fading this way, it means we're probably here. And thankfully we recovered, ended up at the top of this climb, and we were like, oh, we're back on. But you could feel that the mindset was crumbling when we were out there. And it was odd that many hours into it to just feel like sort of the group had sort of become a little bit complacent and almost accepted that, oh, we just let it slip away. Like, I guess it's not the year. It was very odd. Thankfully, when we got back on track as a group, also we went, hey, we've got time. We've got to get back in the game here. And the three of us got back in the game. And from that point forward, navigationally is a lot easier. So we kind of separated a little bit, pushed on in. And I think I got into camp 10 minutes before Jasmine. Greg, who was with us as well, had gotten in a few minutes before me, and he got in and he got out, which is great. So in camp, you have myself and Jasmine sort of in different parts of the little camp getting our acts together. I'm over there getting ready with my wife, Mindy, my crew, and she's up at the gate. And I didn't know what was quite going on, nor did I exactly know the direction of whoever left next would be going a direction. Anyway, eventually I get my stuff together. I'm sort of marching up to the gate, and someone mentions that the next person to leave goes in a clockwise direction. And, you know, she's sitting there right at the gate. And that's the preferred direction for a couple of reasons, but from my opinion, primarily navigation. You know, they're both physically brutal, but navigationally, counterclockwise is much harder. And like the potential to lose a lot of time is much higher there. Anyway, bottom line is I was very committed to finishing the race myself for sure, but I also knew that I have a lot of experience on it and could probably deal with either direction. And so asked her kind of which direction she wanted to go, assumed that would be clockwise, and thankfully some others jumped in and kind of confirmed that, because her response really quickly was, I don't really care. And it's like, I'm betting you care. If not, you should. And so, yeah, I really just kind of asked, hey, if you want to go clockwise, you know, it's all yours. I'm willing to hang out if you're ready to go here soon. And she's like, oh, okay. It was great. I think in a sense, it was great for her. It was great for me, because it sort of motivated her to get her stuff together maybe quicker than she had planned to. And if she left next, she would be in the clockwise direction, which is great. So we hung out there, not for long, just a minute or two. I think she hurried up, got her stuff together, and took off, which is great, which meant that she went one direction clockwise, I went counterclockwise.
This is something that I think is really cool about a lot of Laz's events. Like, one thing we were talking about a lot in camp over 3 days was the backyard ultra concept, and how in those races, one of the things that makes them so interesting is you really can't achieve true greatness in those events unless you have an assist, unless the person who finishes in second is capable of helping deliver that person to, you know, in Harvey Lewis's case at Big's Backyard, something like, I don't know, what was it, 480 miles, something crazy like that. And in that case, you know, Eeyore had to make that amazing assist to get Harvey to that level of greatness that ultimately gets celebrated. And, you know, even to some extent in Barkley, like you talked about earlier there, that there's a lot of room built into the nature of the event where veterans can make assists and you can kind of facilitate a finish. And I think it's super cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyways, I think that story speaks for itself, and it's admirable. It's awesome. And yeah, wanted to make sure people who weren't there and were interested in kind of seeing beyond the headlines, that they were aware of other great stories like this one. And for me, it was kind of one of those moments that cemented interest in the event and a deeper appreciation of you, and wanting to kind of go back and be there again in subsequent years. But moving on, I wanted to ask you a bunch of questions sort of around the culture of Barkley, and I got to read some quotes, and let me pull up my notes here, because I made sure to write them down. But yeah, one thing I appreciated over the course of the 3 days was Laz and, you know, all the, sort of the parables he brought out at various times. And I've got two quotes. I'm going to read one that is long, one that is short, and I'd love to get your reaction to them. The first one is, quote, "You could charge $1,000 per spot and fill it, but you would not have the kind of people that we do. You would just have people who are trying to buy a great experience. And the whole thing about Barkley, you can't buy it with money. You got to buy it with your soul," end quote. The second one, quote, "If you belong here, you will figure out how to get here," end quote. And so I guess my question to you is, do you identify with these sentiments here? Like, is Laz directionally correct with how the Barkley entry process should be structured, and sort of how intensely participants should devote themselves to getting in?
Yeah, I think your first quote there is, I mean, Laz is full of just brilliant quotes, right? That really shape, I think they just shape how we think and You know, I think we're really lucky for the influence that he's had on us, for sure. And I'm so glad we have those little quotes captured. That first one, though, yeah, I think he's spot on with that. I mean, think about this. You know, it's a buck. You know, it's a buck 60 to enter. It's kind of fun to say that, but also think about when you finish, right? You know, my daughters, who, you know, they're at the stage where they want a medal or a trophy. Like, Dad, where's your trophy? You know, it's like, you know, I've never the hardest race I've ever done, Barkley, at least, there's no trophy sitting on any shelf anywhere. There's like nothing, right? And in a way, I think it's a beautiful thing to do that, right? There's no swag bag. There's no cool t-shirt you get to wear. There's none of that. And in a sense, to strip all that crap away, which really doesn't matter. Well, it matters to some people. But to strip it away is a filtration process. Because right there, if something like that is really important to someone, right? The even logging in your Strava, you can't record this. No GPS watch, nothing like this, right? So you strip away all these things that some people want and care about, the trophy, the belt buckle, the shirt, the whatever, the Strava thing. You strip all that crap away. In a sense, it filters out the people where that stuff matters. And it's one way to precipitate through folks who maybe have a more intrinsic motivation for to do it. They care about things for different reasons, right? They're able to, their motivation for it is deeper. It's this personal accomplishment. It's this psychological accomplishment. You know, I think it's a filtration mechanism and I really like it. It's cool. You know, I got lots of belt buckles and silly things like that somewhere stuffed away in a closet that I really don't care about. And in a sense, he's right. You know, he could charge lots of money and you'd get a crowd for sure that would, you know, pay for that experience. There's lots of big, hard things like that, many, many thousands of dollars all over the world. But I think in a sense, it's cool. It gets rid of, it's a filtration process. I guess I'll just say that. And it, you know, the list of people that are still really interested when they realize they get nothing for this, it doesn't cost them anything. They get nothing for it. They get no support. Right there, you just got rid of a whole bunch of people. And so you're sort of honing in on the type of population that really might care in a different way about a challenge like this.
You might have some thoughts here too, because obviously you've been a race director, but one of the things that blew me away just observing the event was, despite how, you know, dangerous, how precarious it can be, everybody survives. And that's something in most races that, you know, I think race directors aspire to, right? Like, you're putting so many guardrails in at every juncture in a race to make sure there's no tragedy, that runners have a great experience. And one of the things that I kind of noticed here was, you know, because it's so tough to get into the event, like you said, it filters for people who have the utmost level of preparation. And even if they don't finish five laps, you know, they're going to walk away relatively intact. They're going to survive.
Yeah, you're spot on. I mean, it's something I've written about and talked about too. It's amazing to me that there aren't more injuries, there aren't more accidents, etc. But then at the same time, it's not that interesting. I think Barkley is an experiment for us all at the way we conduct a big, huge challenge. And some might not know that there is no required list of gear, right? There's no GPS tracker. There's no show me that you have all the stuff and 500 milliliters of water and 2000 calories and a rain poncho and an emergency blanket. Every hard race in the world has that list of stuff, right? And if you're a race director, you kind of have to do that. I'm one myself. And so, I mean, you have to have a safety protocol and you have to have all these things. I actually don't know how you ever don't do that in today's world where you have to get a permit and have all that stuff. I think it's sort of grandfathered into a different way of approaching it, right? Because it's been done this way for so long. But we should look at it. It's fascinating. There is no manual for success there. There is no thing that says if you bring all this stuff and you get to from A to B to C to D, you're going to be successful. You get your belt buckle, right? The result happens to be when there is no path laid out, there is no user manual to Barclay that you go, crap, I better do some homework. I better really think about this in a way that I didn't for that, you know, that other race where I just went to page 7, 8, 9 of the manual and followed what it said. When there is no manual, one human response from the right type of people is, I am going to buckle down and do the homework, right? I'm going to read 50 race reports and I'm going to take notes and just like I'm studying for some class and I'm going to really map it out myself. What worked? What didn't? What's the key? Oh, I should have, you know, a redundant compass and two sets of maps and I should laminate it and I should do this and the ability to filter water. And, you know, like all these, because there is no manual, smart people will do the research themselves. And so again, it's another filtration thing. If their natural reaction to not having things laid out in a manual, if their natural reaction isn't to go do the homework, then they probably also don't have the right mindset to figure out how to get in and to navigate all the other things. So like everything about this from, you know, being cryptic on how to get in, it's a filtration process. And the result is the start line that you see, right? When the cigarette is about to be lit, you look around and you're like, wow, this is an amazing group of humans because, you know, it's humanity filtered down to 40 people who think kind of similarly and are students and they study and they plan and they research and they show up at the start line really prepared. And then you go let them run around this crazy course for many hours and most humans would get broken and lost and have all sorts of things go wrong and somehow there isn't an issue every year. I think it's a byproduct of the way he has set it up to naturally filter the right people who should be there at the start line.
And so, yeah, like you said, you've written about it before, but I'm surprised because, you know, there've been so many interpretations of Barclay over the years and about what it means for the sport. I'm shocked that that's not one of the widespread conclusions that, you know, that there's a playbook for safety that other races theoretically could pull bits and pieces from. And I mean, yeah, as a race director yourself, I don't know if you have any thoughts here, but what comes to mind for you? Like, how do you act with this information?
Yeah. I mean, I'll be honest, like everything I just said about my observation of how he goes about it, and then the result is this prepared, resilient, tough start line. You might think that I would turn around and apply this to my own race, but at the same time, I don't think it's like I don't fault other races for taking the approach they take. It's a really big leap of faith to try to, you know, to try to adopt some of the Barclay philosophies. And I think it works because it's been done this way for so many years. But to start a race and say, hey, I'm going to run it like Laz and give them nothing and let them, you know, I think it's, I don't run my races that way, but I absolutely appreciate what it says, you know. But at the same time, you know, because it's such a difficult challenge, you can almost run it a little bit differently. My races running up for air, as you know, it's not intended to be this, you know, hardest thing in the world kind of thing. Like I want my mom to be able to come and run it. Right. And run the 6 hour, have fun. And I don't want it to be a survival contest for her. So there's a time and place for it. I mean, but I do think it's interesting for us to look at how it's run and what the result seems to be in terms of preparation and issues out there. There's very few issues on a really, really tough course where a lot of issues could happen. I mean, the other thing too, just to hit on it really fast, when you do that research and you do your homework and well, you know, you're going to quickly learn that there's no aid stations. You're going to quickly learn there's no ham radio network and search and rescue guys. In fact, wow, I just read 3 reports of people being lost for 30 hours before they, you know, assembled a search and rescue team. 30 hours. You know, right there, it's shaping. Hopefully you're taking notes on that going, I might have to take care of myself for 30 hours if things really went wrong. Given that, what am I going to take with me, right? So anyway, I don't know. It's fascinating to me. I love it for what it is. I don't I don't want people to think I'm suggesting that that approach should be used everywhere, but it sure is an interesting data point for us.
Yeah, it's as I begin my sort of Barkley fandom journey, it's just one of the layers of the race that I wasn't, that, you know, that wasn't readily apparent to me even a year or two ago. And as I've gotten deeper into the race and gotten to the ground level, it's just right there in front of you and you're blown away. But switching topics, you know, I was there as a member of the media, and I'll preface it by saying I love Laz. I can't wait to hang out with him again if he'll have me back in future years. But I could certainly tell that myself and everyone else in my group, the media group, we were not necessarily wanted. We were tolerated. And I really appreciate that. But it makes me wonder, you know, because we're seeing Barkley increasingly blow up on social media each year. Have you noticed any differences in this respect? Like, is there any reason to worry about a possible modernizing of Barkley and losing any parts about what make it so fundamental because of the media's increasing involvement?
I don't think because of the media's involvement, no. I mean, I think he has pretty carefully conducted things in a way where he's tried to not let it become too over the top. I will say in recent years, not this year, but it's been over the top in terms of media in and around the park. I mean, in terms of the, you know, how broad the stories go and the people that they touch. Oh my gosh, I have to think this year was probably the biggest for sure. But that all happens kind of outside of the scene. Once you're in the race and in the park, and the minute you leave the gate and you're out on the course, like, it feels the same to me for sure. But I think your question, you know, can and, you know, could the media change the way it's conducted? I mean, I don't know. I think if it was going to, it would have, because there's been quite a bit of attention the last 10 years on it. So I hope that it doesn't change the way that it's conducted.
I guess in general then, is there anything you worry about when it comes to the future of the race that you kind of feel compelled to protect?
I mean, I guess as more and more media wants to be part of it. The funny thing to me is I feel like, you know, there's always nuggets, like there's always stories within each year's race that are probably worth telling. But as a participant for a lot of years, I feel like, hey man, you know, the Barkley story's been told. At least I feel like it has, you know, like, move on. You know, we don't need to tell it again. We don't need six more documentaries this year. I mean, maybe we do, actually. We probably do because of what happened at the finish line there with Jasmine. That definitely deserves a documentary. But to some extent, I feel it's overdone and overtold from my perspective. I would have thought people would have lost interest at this point because it's been told so many times, but I think there's still such a great appetite because it's so different than most other races that more and more outlets are going to try to figure out some way to tell that story. In terms of how it protects, you know, I hope that ethos doesn't change. I love that it is what it is. I love that there isn't, I hope that a lot of the attention that it's getting doesn't eventually put so much sort of, you know, risk that insurance jumps in and makes some change to the way it's conducted. I mean, that could happen in our society. That would be really sad to me if somehow from that angle they mandated that the race changed how it's conducted. That would be an unfortunate thing for sure.
Last question I have here on Barkley, and then I want to talk about some of the more local Wasatch area topics. There are, as I've said earlier, there's a lot of interpretations of Barkley out there, especially from people who have not yet experienced the event on the ground. If there was something you could communicate to the general population about it, what would be your message? Like, what would you perhaps want them to understand that you think might be misunderstood in sort of the way things have been interpreted to date?
Well, I think people have, you know, like the like maybe the more traditional ultra running community has always looked at it like it's kind of this funny fringe thing or just this orienteering event, a bunch of people with compasses, you know, navigating around the neighborhood, you know, around the woods. But I think that's changed and people are starting to really acknowledge what a sort of athletic feat it really is, I think, you know. And especially as we get better and better athletes coming out to do it and really some pretty increasingly high profile people. In fact, I remember when I was out there in 2012, Carl Laniak said to me, "Thanks for coming out here to like sort of validate what this race is," or something, you know. And that was 12 years ago. Fast forward to now, I think people go, I think the general ultra running community is really starting to see what it is. It's not an orienteering race. And what I tell people is, if you approach it like an orienteering race, then you're guaranteed to be too slow and you will never stand a chance of finishing. So I don't know. I guess I would hope that people could see that part of why it's so challenging is that it's this interesting fusion of endurance and athleticism, but also kind of a cognitive event as well, making decisions and planning and all this. And I guess I would hope that people are starting to see just how special that can be. You know, a lot of people write it off because it's just some, you know, scavenger hunt navigation thing. And you could look at it through that lens if you want. But I think people are starting to realize what an incredible, thing it can be when you fuse together different challenges, physically, endurance, cognitively, planning. I mean, I think it's sort of starting to be seen for its uniqueness by combining all those things. And the result is more and more people are becoming obsessed and wanting to do it. You know, when I first got into Hard Rock a long time ago, that was viewed as this kind of outsider fringe race. You know, most runners wouldn't be interested at all. Fast forward now, I mean, that's one of the most sought after mountain races in the world, right? But it wasn't that long ago that people thought it's kind of just this, you know, funny challenge in the mountains for a bunch of hikers, you know? And now it's like the gold standard. Well, Barclay is like another leap away, but I think quite interesting in the sense that it combines a lot of elements together. And that's why it's so hard. So I don't know. I guess I would hope that people would take the time to learn what it really is and not just write it off for some, you know, scavenger hunt in the woods.
Very cool. Well, yeah, I'd like to talk about the Wasatch now. I have many questions for you on this front. And the first topic I want to discuss with you is the Millwood 100, which, you know, I feel like when people think about you, they think a lot about Barclay, running up for air. And then when they think about route creation, most people think about the whirl. But the one that has always captivated me the most is Millwood. And I'd love to get some backstory on it. Like when you were starting to imagine and devise this route, what were you doing at the time in your running career? What were you impressed by? What were you inspired by? And how did that all kind of fuse into what you built here?
Yeah, it's a good question. Yeah, I guess for those who don't know, Millwood is the Millwood 100 is this do-it-on-your-own kind of course here in the Wasatch Mountains, just outside of Salt Lake City. You know, before I was a runner, I was a climber. That's why I've always been drawn to events that are pretty rugged, at least, certainly in the mountains. If they have some scrambling, that's kind of cool. But I've always really liked kind of hard mountain, you know, challenges. And we live in the Wasatch Mountains, you and I do, and it's one of the most amazing places in the world. And, you know, there's a bunch of great races here and iconic races. The Wasatch 100, you know, it's been around 44 years, I think, one of the earliest ones. Great races for sure. But as I started to evolve, I guess, in my endurance runs myself, I'm like, man, I'm looking at the Wasatch and I'm like, there's potential for like a really, really hard 100-mile race. And, you know, let's come up with something. You know, this is such a cool, like the Tri Canyons here, you know, big Little Cottonwood, Mill Creek Canyon. You know, this is where I kind of grew up. And so to some extent, I guess what shaped it was me just looking for a way to make a much harder 100-mile race right in the heart of the Wasatch in those canyons, Mill Creek and the Cottonwoods. And so in a sense, and I love mapping too. I just geek out, you know, coming up with, you know, routes and building timetables and spreadsheets and stuff like that. So in a sense, it was, as I was evolving and thinking about things like Nolan's 14, which is a hard mountain thing, and the Barkley and things like this, I'm like, man, we need a proper 100 here. And, you know, some of the best terrain anywhere in the United States, you usually can't do in a race. National parks, you can't hold in national parks. Wilderness areas, you can't go into wilderness areas with an official race. And so I kind of knew from the get-go, it would just be this thing I'd put out there. Here's a course. Here's a map, right? And a little bit of information about it. And it's beautiful. It's hard. Physically, mentally, and just sort of put it out there and see what people would think of it. So I put quite a bit of thought into the course. It looks like a bit of a spaghetti bowl, but if you zoom in a little bit closer and you kind of follow the logic, it's not just a messy course. It's actually a pretty neat and logical way to weave in and out of some of the best parts of the Central Wasatch here.
And why do you think the Whirl, and for those that aren't familiar with the acronym, it's the Wasatch Ultimate Ridge Link Up. What are your theories on why the Whirl has generally had more fanfare in the trail running space, you know, the last 10 to 15 years?
That's a really good question. I actually would have thought the other way around, because it's easier to look at the Millwood 100 like another 100, because it is another 100. It's a little bit more challenging in some sections than a Hard Rock, let's say. But, you know, the Whirl's kind of a scrambling route. So it has been interesting to me. They've both been out there for a while. It's been interesting that the Whirl has caught on a bit more. I don't really know how to explain it, to be honest, other than maybe it's been out for more time. People have had time to think about it. Both are, the Whirl too, for those who don't know, kind of circumnavigates Little Cottonwood, the ridge line that sort of defines the iconic Little Cottonwood here in the Wasatch. Maybe numerically it seems less daunting. It's 34, 35 miles. That sounds like less than 100. And I think it is. But maybe that's why more people try it. It just seems more manageable than a hard 100. But then when people get into it, they realize the Whirl, even though, you know, 30-something miles, it's like the effort of 100 for most people. But it's pretty stunning. I don't know. I think it's cool that the Whirl has caught on, because it pushes climbers for sure on terrain they're not used to. Or it pushes runners onto terrain they're not used to necessarily. And so a lot of trail runners, I thankfully have learned a lot about how to move on technical terrain, and hopefully are safe in doing so, because there's some dangerous sections on it.
One last break to mention a new partner that I am really excited about, and that is Delta G Ketones. You've heard me talk about and support the use of ketones in performance settings like ultramarathons many times over the last couple of years. I've personally included exogenous ketones in my own training and racing during that stretch. And after taking roughly 6 months to do more research in this area of nutrition, particularly since last August, what turned me on to Delta G was that its products allow individuals to achieve deep states of ketosis safely and immediately in both performance and recovery contexts. I'll have much more to add about how and why I use Delta G in future episodes, but one of the biggest reasons I support this company is because it's got the only products out there that get individuals to achieve these beneficial levels of ketosis safely. So if you're interested and you want to check out their range of products, I encourage you to visit their website, deltagketones.com. And if you end up making a purchase, feel free to use code SINGLETRACK20 at checkout for 20% off your next order. Keeping with the spirit of spotlighting interesting but maybe non-traditional or lower key courses and races, I was scrolling your ultra sign up and saw that in recent years you've done the Wyoming Range 100, Stanhope 100, and the Plain 100. And I think for a lot of people out there, these might be new-ish race names. So I'd love for you to talk more about these. Like, which, maybe of the three, which one were you the most stoked on after the fact and why?
Yeah. Well, I guess you made an observation of something that I maybe is part of my MO a little bit, which is to try to find that thing that's not popular. Like, that to me is interesting. Once a race becomes really popular, I actually lose a lot of interest, right? So maybe I don't want to say forte, but maybe the way I go about things is intentionally to find that thing that's that quiet gem. And there's a lot of them around here for sure. And I like to kind of jump in. And that was actually hard rock when I first got into it. It was an obscure thing. That was Barkley when I first got into it. It was an obscure thing. And they've both kind of gone, you know, pretty big and blown up. Those races you mentioned, Standhope is really, it's a stunning race. The Wyoming Range 100, amazing. And I feel like I can see the evolution of something that's really, really good. And I go, oh my gosh, like I want to go experience that when it's small. Because that's the fun stage. And when it's messy too, this might sound a little odd, but I actually kind of like the early race, like when stuff goes wrong or when they haven't figured out the logistics and maybe an aid station's missing. And so as a runner, you sort of have to, you go, oh my gosh, this is the first year or the second year or the third year, stuff's going to go wrong. In a way, it's kind of this extra fun variable, at least for me. And I kind of like that. I like the messy early stage, you know. Let's see, Plain 100's actually been going for quite a while and it's been off the radar for a long time. But the other two are actually pretty new and they're both awesome. I know the race directors for both Standhope and Wyoming Range. Yeah, they're both incredible for sure. I mean, the Wyoming I did most recently, I did that just last year, and absolutely amazing race. The group that heads that up isn't trying to just turn it into a UTMB thing and blow it up really big. You know, they're stepping into it very intentionally and so much thought into making the experience and the course great. In fact, this year, I think they open up registration here soon. It's a new course. It's modified. But I love that intentionality. You know, the course director for that is sort of like me with the Millwood. It's like, I want this to be great. I actually don't care at all about the scaling of it and drawing crowds. I just want to come up with a beautiful adventure, you know, that's just beautiful just because. Beautiful and hard and challenging. And I'm not going to... I'm not a marketer. I'm not trying to pull in hundreds of people or thousands of people. You know, that's the mindset of really both of those races. And they're really great. And to some extent, too, I guess I do jump into those races with the thought of like, I want to see how it is. And then I want to help, you know, help the RDs who have created something really great. I mean, I'll even ask them at the end, would you like me to turn around and help broadcast this and draw people to your event? So that's me seeing all the effort that they're putting in, huge effort per person running it. And if they want to grow it and want to pull in extra people, you know, I'd like to be there to sort of help them with that.
I'd heard wild stories about Wyoming. Like you have to carry a bear canister on that course, right? Because you've got grizzlies.
Yeah. Back to the whole required gear comment. Yeah. There's actually a lot of required gear on that for good reason. I mean, it's the right call for that type of race. There's big times between aid stations. And so there's a laundry list of stuff you got to bring, including bear spray.
Yeah. I do think, you know, you said earlier that one of the things that keeps you interested in the scene is sort of always being on the lookout for the undiscovered. And in terms of the adoption curve, you're very, very much an early adopter. This is more a comment to the audience, but I think that is an interesting way to approach races and personal projects in our sport, especially as people get frustrated by wait lists and kind of circling around the same 4 to 5 events each year. And yeah, I just think there's good reason to reflect on your position and sort of putting your antennas up for where the bleeding edge in the sport is and whether it's worth hanging out there too, because I think there's a lot of value in the new.
Yeah. I'm an early adopter to a fault for sure. in lots of things, not just running and adventures. It's kind of how I lead my life. I mean, I'm excited by the new thing and always willing to jump in and try and learn and fail. And, you know, whoever's leading and going first or one of the early tends to learn a lot. The other thing is, I guess maybe, I don't know if you're trying to wrap up, but one thought to share with, to share with people though is, you know, as a community, as we start to hone in on these races that become the center of our universe, let's use Hard Rock as an example, because I have so many friends who, you know, their whole world revolves around Hard Rock in their mind, because we haven't stopped to think about why. Is there something, you know, just because we become obsessed with certain things and we happen to desire the things that we can't have, generally speaking. I think it's a human trait. The more out of reach something is, the more we desire it. Well, when it comes to doing adventures, if you're trying to push yourself, you do a 100-mile race, there is so much else out there. And so try to put on your early adopter hat a little bit if you didn't get in the lottery for whatever race that matters more than life itself to you. There's 10 other races that are amazing and hard and probably every bit as beautiful. Just pivot, because you'll save yourself some, you know, mental anxiety that you can't get in the lottery for 10 years at Hard Rock, right? And there's so many people in that camp. There's a whole bunch of other adventures. You know, roll out the map like I tend to do and plan something in the nearby range, right? Go to the Sangre de Cristos, go do Nolan's. So maybe a message, a public service announcement to try to help people who feel devastated when they don't get in some race that presumably means a lot to them is, you know, tilt your vision just a degree or two and see what else is out there, or plan your own thing. There's endless things to do out there.
Do you mind if I ask a few more questions?
Sure. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. You've done this amazing job, in my opinion, of sort of creating supply for the local Wasatch community to kind of stay local and do cool stuff. And I've been wondering in the last few years, like, are you done creating, or are there more things in the future that you are going to present to us locals through the blog?
That's a great question. I'm a lifelong creator for sure. So I don't plan to stop creating by any means. You know, most might know that I have two little kids that occupy a lot of my time. So my adventure is like a little bit different these days, but still in my heart absolutely is coming up with fun routes, mainly because I feel like it's a strength of mine and maybe a weakness of others to plan out things and roll out maps. And I love to do that. And it's been really fun to see the purpose that a couple of the things I've put together have brought to people and to the community. So I absolutely intend to keep doing that for sure.
On the environmental aspect of all this, where do you currently stand on the move towards more local endurance pursuits in general? Like, are you an advocate for people doing this as much as possible all the time, or do you see it as more of a nuanced thing where, you know, there's reason to kind of go abroad or to go across the US and trail run there?
That's a really good question. I mean, it's easy to say this when we live in a place where within a very short distance we have just endless adventure, but I do think a lot about my footprint, right? And I used to travel a lot more than I do now. I used to go to Europe all the time. And I am pretty intentional about trying to adventure more local. But I also acknowledge the fact that I have an incredible luxury to do so with the Wasatch here and, you know, awesome, the Uintas to the east and the desert not far away. I mean, but without, you know, pushing people to just crawl in a cave and not have any fun in life, to the extent that you can come up with your own projects nearby, I think that's good style is maybe how I would describe it. If you are able to adventure locally, you know, now at the same time, so much of my life, whether I was a climber or a runner, the most shaping things I've ever done started with some report I read or a picture I saw that drew me across the country or across the world. And that changed who I am as a person. So I don't ever think that people should, for environmental reasons, deny themselves being inspired and enjoying life for sure. Because I think a lot of goodness comes when you travel, when you see people, when you meet different cultures, when you're running with 10 people from all over the world. I think there's a lot of goodness that can come out of that. So we're in this, you know, time where we have to be smart about things. We have to be conscientious about the impact that we have on things. I've read something from Jasmine, actually, that I thought was quite cool as I was researching her a little bit. And she, I loved it that she was very intentional about, you know, sort of committing to one big trip this year, Barclay, right? She also, I think, maybe wanted to put in for the Hard Rock Lottery, speaking of that, and said, well, you know, I feel good about traveling for one event, and I don't feel good about traveling, you know, across the pond multiple times in one year. So for her, she had this way of going about things, and she was intentional and conscientious about it. And I don't know, there's no one size fits all by any means. For me, I love the concept, the thought of adventuring local. And I think for a lot of people who have access, we can come up with some really cool things right in our backyards. And oftentimes our backyard, we have a strong personal connection to it. So I guess I do encourage people to look local if they can.
I think there's probably a cross section of this audience that would find this next topic interesting, but you've done a lot when it comes to, I think it's called net zero, net positive living. And talk about that, because I think when we think about all the buckets of environmentalism and the reflections on where we consume versus where we generate, you have some pretty interesting ideas and projects that you've acted on in your own personal life. And there's a great article, by the way, in the Salt Lake Tribune for you listeners out there that we will add to the show notes about how you retrofitted your first house. And I think you're doing it on your current place as well. So yeah, talk about that whole concept some more.
Yeah. I mean, so this is another thing totally unrelated to the prior topics. But, you know, for me as a scientist, as an engineer, as a human, many years ago, I really just said, how do I, in terms of the actual tangible daily impact that we have, right? Which means like the place we live, the way we move around, you know, if I put my like Boy Scout hat on, how do I try to leave the place better than I found it? It's like a Boy Scout mindset, right? How do I leave the trail better than I found it? How do I leave the campsite better than I found it? And, you know, many years ago, just started the wheels turning on, you know, can I build a little dwelling, right? We all need a place to live. Can I modify or build this building, this dwelling, this home that I live in a way that is net zero? And what that really means is that the structure itself produces the same amount of energy as it consumes. Net positive would be that it produces more than it consumes, right? And when you start with that first question, you have to go, well, how much energy do I use? What do I use energy for, right? And you start to do like an energy audit of your own life. And, you know, we in Utah, we use, you know, many of us use natural gas to heat things with a furnace or a hot water heater. We use a lot of electricity for lights and computers and, you know, dryers and ovens and ranges and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, I kind of started tallying it all up. And just like training for a race, you start measuring things, right? And you got to plan it all out. So what's my baseline? And that's kind of where we start is like, all right, now I know how many, you know, I use 4.6 megawatt hours of electricity and so many decatherms of natural gas, you know, whatever the numbers are, doesn't matter. The point is we measured them and then we say, okay, well, now I got to go learn about building science and I got to learn about architecture and, you know, solar angles and all this kind of stuff. And we kind of honed in on building this home that was like a passive solar home, meaning that the geometry of it and the materials and the windows and the placement of things are such that we could harness all the free energy from the sun when we wanted it in the winter, and we could block it out all the other times of the year. Right, that's like really simple, free use of energy that's hitting our house. Anyway, so planning, studying, thinking, right, just kind of like getting ready for Barclay. a lot of planning, reading, looking from lots of different angles. Eventually, we tore our little house down and rebuilt it with the objective of being net positive. And you know, we went through this crazy process. My wife and I did most of the work ourselves. And eventually we moved back in. Everyone's like, great, the project's done. Congratulations. And I'm like, no, the project has started. Started in the sense that, okay, once we moved in, the clock started and I wanted a calendar year of data. How did it work? You know, what did my models predict? terms of energy usage. We did all these things to make it efficient, to require very little energy. And then how did it work out? So we did a whole year of collecting data, and then we turned around and shared it with the community, like how it turned out. And that to me was kind of the conclusion of the project, is measuring it all and then sharing it. That was like the final chapter there, is sharing what we had learned with the community. And the beautiful thing is, out of a number of presentations I did on it, I would say it had a positive effect. There were a number of developers and home builders and things of this nature who saw what I did, and one even completely rebranded their company, and all they've done since then is net positive communities. And to me, that, you know, people say, what's the return on investment on your solar panels? You know, when do they pay for themselves? And I'm like, that's a really shallow way to look at the payback. In my mind, something like a business rebranding from just generic homes built in Utah to all they do is net positive communities factors into Jared's equation for return on investment. It's hard to put a number on it, but man, did it matter a lot to me that we moved the needle locally on how stuff gets built, right? And now, you know, since then, there have probably been, you know, multi-hundreds amounts of homes built in a different way than they would have if they didn't see what we had done. Hugely valuable intrinsically to me. I can't put in a little equation and say that the return on my solar panels was, you know, whatever. But it really mattered to me, and I really care about that kind of impact, you know, like qualitative impact.
Yeah. So when you were in the process of doing all this work on your house, I'm very curious about how disconnected versus centralized all the information out there was, not just to make this successful for you and your family, but also just like baseline possible from financial and logistical standpoint. So I guess based on what you were able to do, and now kind of looking back 5-10 years on, are we at a better point where like what you're describing is possible for the average citizen?
Oh yeah. So when we did it, I mean, and we built that home. There's a second story as well. If we had more time, we could dive into a second home, which is where I live now. But at the time when we built that, that was back in 2011, you know, it was totally new, much more expensive than it is today. The technology wasn't quite there. You know, the permitting process was confusing. The local building department didn't know what to do with the things I had put on my plans. How are you going to heat this place? Wait, what? What do you plan to do? They didn't know how to do it. I mean, we were early adopters, right? We were signing up for the race that no one else knew about or cared about. And that was fun. And, you know, I guess from a cost standpoint, since you asked about that, solar at the time, let's see, I did my first solar array in 2008, actually. So it was even before our whole house project. But I think solar at the time was like $5 per watt is sort of a metric there. It's like below 70 cents per watt at this point. And so it has come down enormously. At this stage, in my opinion, it's an absolute no-brainer to do solar, especially if you're building new, and then the retrofits and doing it after the fact can also really be a no-brainer as well. We're in this weird mode where like the rate structures with the utility kind of can change the economics of it. But I mean, if you care, if the thought of producing the energy that you consume is important to you as a person, then it's, you know, that also factors into that return on investment. And at least in my mind, it does. And most people don't. I guess I think differently than a lot, but, you know, like going to a campground and finding pride when you walk away knowing that you picked up all the trash before you left, right? There's no return on investment on picking up the trash when you leave it as a Boy Scout, but it might matter to you. To me, I feel the same about producing the energy that I consumed, because pollution is created when we consume electricity from, you know, a coal-fired power plant, right? So I really think about it the same way. I take pride in, I feel good in my heart when I leave the campground, or, you know, I'm making an analogy here, but when I can say, yep, I cleaned up all the crap that my, you know, I cleaned up all the pollution that my house produced, i.e. I'm, you know, my home's net zero. That matters in my heart. And it would be awesome if humanity could kind of rally around that mindset a bit more. And if we could, the technologies are there. The prices have come down so much in all the pieces that go into making an efficient home and transportation, I would say. And we've just got to start to look at it through that lens and not there's such a tendency to just turn it into this, like, you know, this simplified business calculation about, did I get my money back for that? You know, what's the return? I get asked that all the time. And I'm like, you just got to look at it a little differently. Like, there's something really gratifying about cleaning up after yourself, producing the energy that you consume.
In the social cost too, right? But yeah, are you seeing like entire subdivisions going up following this blueprint, or like, are we even there yet in terms of scale, or is this sort of like a one by one basis movement still?
I think we are starting to see it. We're still in a mode right now where the builders building this way are charging quite a premium for it, you know? So if you go out and say, hey, oh man, I really want this net positive house, unfortunately, we're still in a mode where that means you're going to pay a lot of money. And so it needs to be normalized more, I would argue. And, you know, we're turning this into a home building conversation here, but the reality is, if you're in that stage, you, with a few different decisions, like design decisions on a home design, you can greatly simplify the complexity of the design and put that cost savings into the efficiency. You still end up with a great house, and you can do it in a way that doesn't cost you more, but you have to give up some of the things like complexity. An example might be, I'll give you a quick example. If you were bird's eye view looking down at a house, you know, today's houses are complex. Imagine the foundation of a home. You know, there's 30 different little jogs in the foundation, and then the framing is really complex because it's got to follow that really complex puzzle piece of a foundation. If you simplify that, if you greatly simplify the geometric footprint of it, everything gets cheaper in terms of what's built on top of it. All the framing, the plumbing, electrical, the windows, everything gets, the roof, everything does. So a few smart decisions, and this is where builders need to help people be more informed about it. If you could get rid of every little jog in the complex footprint, you're going to save tens of thousands of dollars with every little decision. Think about it at the early stages and then put that cost savings into better windows, better insulation, solar. And if you think about it the right way, you can do it in a way that doesn't cost you more. But I don't think the building community, architectural community, is quite at the stage where they're helping people make smart decisions.
Okay. Yeah. We'll make sure to link to all of it in the show notes. Maybe I can grab some links from you offline. And for anyone that's interested in investigating this further, we'll have all that ready for you. But the last question that I want to ask you, I guess it's philosophical, but just based on my observations, and I would argue most observations in our local trail community, you know, you're an engineer, you're an athlete, you're a race director, you're an environmentalist, you're a family person, you do all of them well, you operate incredibly efficiently, it seems. And I guess I'm wondering, like, what do you attribute that to? And maybe setting aside intelligence and the gifts associated with that, do you have a particular worldview that keeps you on track? Is it something else? Because I've always been curious.
I married an amazing woman. I'll just end it there. Yeah, I don't know. I do think there's a lot to that. I've, you know, Mindy, my wife, who hopefully many people are aware of, I attribute she is a partner in so many of the things we've talked about here, whether it's, you know, some athletic feat or home building feat that we talked about. She and I we're on the same page. We're on the same team. She has her own identity and I do as well. And we just are able to really help each other, accomplish the things we want to, for sure. So she's really, you know, she's very smart and practical about things, but also not afraid to dream. I'm a dreamer in a lot of ways. And then, thankfully we both are able to put our heads together and execute quite well also. Let's see, what else? You know, we're pretty intentional about our time and cutting out things that really don't matter or that our time sucks. For until very recently, I never had a TV in my house. Until you know, our kids kind of grew up and eventually we wanted to watch movies as a family, when I like literally never had a TV until I was 40 probably. I put a lot of thought into eliminating things from my life that I don't want to waste. There's endless opportunities of things you can waste your time on, right? And so I'm pretty intentional about where and how I spend my time.
Yeah, maybe high signal to noise, less susceptible to distractions, and kind of knowing what is core to the mission and what is or what can be expended.
High signal to noise, I like it. Well put. That's a good engineering term there. I like that. Yeah, I mean, totally. In fact, you know, humanity right now, there's so many places vying for your attention and your eyeballs, right, and your attention, that we all have to become very intentional about where we choose to invest our time, right? If you spend an hour watching something, listening to something, I mean, hopefully this podcast is value added for people and worth their time. But I think, you know, do a little personal audit about how and where you spend your time, and you're probably going to come up with a bunch of things that really aren't worth it. They were wastes of time. And if you want to do a whole bunch of things, like I sure do, you know, you have to really filter out stuff that matters and doesn't, and spend your time intentionally, and marry the right person. You know, find the right partner who you can really tackle big things with.
Awesome. Well, Jared, I really appreciate your time. Thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. I know that you provided a lot of insight that the audience is really going to appreciate and take from. We'll make sure to link to all the topics and references mentioned in the episode inside the show notes. We'll link to all of your social media as well. I always like to give the guest the last word. Is there anything that you want to leave listeners with? Any calls to action or just final thoughts?
Well, maybe we'll circle back to the Barclay thing, because that's where we started. And we spent a little bit of time on why this year was so special and with what Jasmine did. And, you know, a lot of people did amazing things. But I think the barrier that she broke through is the huge story for all of us, for all the participants, for me, for others. And, you know, I'm so happy for her. I'm so happy for what that means for the world, for the community, and just what it tells us about barriers and limits, right? And for so many years, Barclay itself was perceived to be hard or impossible for anyone, and then someone did it. A bunch of years later, 19 people had done it, and then she did it. And I think that's just so awesome for all of us. And so, you know, why don't we end on that note, where limits should always be questioned. Anytime society or your own mind or your family or anyone might say something isn't possible, you know, with enough time and effort, it might take multiple years. It might take unbelievable amounts of effort. It's fun to see people overcome things. And I think that applies to anyone, you know, whether you're Jasmine accomplishing what she did, or someone who thinks doing a 5K in the neighborhood is like, let's say that's some huge barrier for someone, which I'm sure it is for a lot of people. You know, look to that example as an incredible story of what's possible and overcoming boundaries.